Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly
Welcome
show
to
of
Heartland
news,
Labor
information,
Forum.
And comments.
Tonight's show is being underwritten by Communications Workers Local 6360 and Electrical Workers Local 53. Communications Workers Local 6360 stands for worker rights, supports union-made products, and encourages you to buy them to help all of us keep good jobs. And IBEW Local 53 represents construction linemen, electric, gas, and water utility workers, broadcast engineers at TV stations, line clearance workers, linemen for rural electric cooperatives, employees at rural electric generating stations, and anyone else who's interested. And we thank our underwriters for their contribution to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, did senators go hungry today alongside the workers who feed them? We'll hear about the strike in the Senate cafeteria. It's part of the Fight for 15. And then, is the practice of tipping a vestige of slavery? That's what Rock United coordinator Saru Jayaraman says. She organizes restaurant workers. In the news, justice for janitors targets substandard conditions, and Fight for 15 strikes today. Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle with Arianna Eckel. And now for the news.
And the news from our side. Today, workers across the country are chanting, "We demand 15-2," and that was emboldened by victories in California, New York, Pennsylvania, and fast food workers also in Kansas City walked off the job. It's one of a record 320 strikes nationwide, demanding 15 an hour and union rights. More than fast food workers, today's strike also included home care, child care, gas station, and Truman Hospital workers who were protesting against low pay and tax avoidance by corporations. But the target for today's actions is clearly McDonald's as a symbol of McPoverty and what's wrong with the economy. This morning, before sunrise, local and fast food cooks and cashiers walked off the job and rallied at McDonald's in Kansas City, Kansas. The signs read, "McJobs cost all, and McWages hold us all back." Underpaid workers poured into Kansas City streets Thursday, stressing days ahead of tax day that low wages and tax avoidance by companies like McDonald's are actually holding back workers and communities across the country. Workers zeroed in on McDonald's because they are the world's second largest employer and the industry leader in the fast food area and service economies, and that's driving a race to the bottom that is undercutting wages across the economy and resulting in nearly 64 million workers being paid less than $15. Terrence Wise, who's a fast food worker, said, "We need 15-2. He's paid just $8 after 29 years of service in the industry. If workers in New York and California and Pennsylvania can join together and win 15, we can win 15 in other parts of the country, too." At 12:30, child care workers called for investment in our child's future with a rally. And that was, again, at 5:30 this afternoon, a major march that was adorned by dynamic protest art and accompanied by a booming drum corps that converged upon McDonald's on Truce to make their message loud and clear.
The General Brotherhood of Workers of American Apparel, representing thousands of apparel workers in the greater Los Angeles metropolitan area, has declared an international boycott of American apparel and is calling on consumers to stop buying anything produced by the company, whether in a retail store or online. Stephanie Padilla dos Santos, president of the independent union, said, quote, "Our response to the company's firing of hundreds of workers is to boycott American apparel. This is no longer a sweatshop-free company as originally founded in 1998 and developed over the years with immigrant workers. Hundreds of thousands of apparel production piecework is subcontracted now to exploitative sweatshops throughout the region where minimum wage is not guaranteed and the workers receive no benefits. It is the end of an era for American apparel," Padilla concluded. The union staged continuous protests all day at American Apparel's offices in Los Angeles. And the union has an election petition pending with the National Labor Relations Board and seeks to be certified as the exclusive collective bargaining agent for the company that employs 4,300 workers.
The Center for Media and Democracy has a blockbuster revelation garnered from a webinar for state chambers of commerce officials held by the National Chamber. The training was done by the Frank Luntz firm. revealed in PowerPoint slides are the results of polling of business owners on a variety of workers' rights issues. Lunce Global, a GOP pollster, surveyed 1,000 business executives and found that huge majorities of business leaders actually support raising the minimum wage, paid sick leave, predictive scheduling, expanded family medical leave, and paternity leave. The point of the training, however, was to teach local chamber officials how to overcome the empathy of their business members and appear reasonable in trying to defeat these popular policies. Yesterday, local workers and activists gathered to take action in support of janitors looking to bargain for a fair contract once their current one expires in May. The contractors with which the local have contracts are playing hardball and proposing to give janitors only a 15-cent raise. Janitors are looking to escalate the pressure on a number of building owners who use these subcontractors. The action involved a rally, a march, and speeches from local figures. Among the individuals who made speeches were a fast food worker who discussed the importance of standing up for each other to fight for better wages. While earning enough money to feed oneself and one's family is hardly a laughing matter, there was a lighter note in the event when a leader began chanting, "What do we want?" And a few fast food workers responded with 15 and a union. Even though yesterday's event was not about the fight for 15, everyone there was excited for today's big events, taking place as we speak, starting at 63rd and Paseo. While the janitors are already organized with the SEIU and are not intending to bargain for $15, a local Baptist minister used the moment to affirm that all workers deserve 15 an hour and more, as well as the right to an organized workplace, and that even though that was not the center of yesterday's action, it is an important goal for the future. An activist with Jobs with Justice also gave a rousing speech, and many people in their cars honked their support for the march as it snaked through downtown. The news tonight was read by Beth Pike, Tino Scalisi, and myself, Ariana Eckel.
And that was the Union Song by Tom Morello. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. On tonight's program, we ask the question, what the hell is going on at the United States Capitol? Why are senators going hungry? Could it be that, like the workers who serve them, they don't always have enough money to eat? Or is it rather that their food source has been cut off by the 80 or so service workers engaged in an occupation strike in the Senate cafeteria? To help us answer that question, we're going to go live in just a moment or two with Bertrand Olatera, veteran food service worker, culinary artist, writer, poet, single father of five, and workers' rights activist and organizer with Washington, D.C.-based Good Jobs Nation. Okay, so for those of you in our listening audience who are maybe a little unfamiliar with what's going on, the Senate cafeteria workers, Fight for 15 and a Union, really began in 2012 in New York City's Times Square, when a small group of McDonald's workers walked out in the middle of their shift to protest poverty wages and poor working conditions. They touched off a wave of organized resistance from virtually every sector of the economy in which low-wage workers were at. And so recently, Good Jobs Nation filed legal claims and even won modest gains for their workers, and are now, with faith leaders across the nation, focused on getting presidential candidates to push government service contractors to pay a minimum of $15 an hour and not retaliate against workers who want to form a union. Bertrand, welcome to the show.
Welcome, Tony.
How are you, man?
I'm fine. I can't complain. I'm doing good. I'm doing great.
And for those of you in Kansas City who don't know, Bertrand was actually a food service worker at Harrah's Casino. When was that, Bertrand?
That was back in 99, 2000. I was a cook in a cafe, in Harrah's Casino.
In Harrah's Casino? So you and I are pretty much like brothers. I mean, we're both from Kansas City, and I also worked. I worked at the Ameristar Casino, just a little bit down the road.
Oh, that's the next one over. And I went to Penn Valley Community College.
Penn Valley. It's right across the street from where we're at.
Yeah, show me state. I miss Kansas City, Missouri. Well, I miss it.
Well, we want to have you back just whenever you get done doing whatever you're doing in D.C. By the way, what brought you to D.C.?
Oh, that's school. I just came back to from school, studying, and, you know, that's the only reason. I was living in D.C., and I went to Kansas City, Missouri. I spent a year and a half, and then I transferred my credit to D.C.
And so when did you start working at the United States Senate cafeteria? Was that your first job when you went back to D.C.?
No, that's not my first job. I started working on the Senate by, I think, January 16, 2014. January 16, 2014, mm-hmm. almost 2 years.
And were you involved in the with Good Jobs Nation and organizing on the job right at the very onset, or is this something you got involved in recently?
I got involved a year already I was involved because I thought that was the only way to speak out, because being silent doesn't solve the problem. That's why I joined the fight, and I've been on strike 7 times. Today was the 8th time I went on strike, because we have to fight poverty. We have to push any candidate, any president for $15 in the union. That's going to be a first step to end poverty in the U.S.
So today wasn't your first strike. Today was your, did you say your 8th?
Yeah, the 8th one, yeah, the 8th one.
And, okay, so do you normally work in the morning or in the afternoon? What is your shift there?
Well, the shift is, I work in the morning. I work in the morning from 6 to 2:30. Mm-hmm. And in the past, I got 2 jobs. You know, I have 2 jobs. I work 7 days a week.
Wow. And so when you walked in this morning, what happened?
When I walk in the morning, I went to strike. Because it's nothing. I want to strike, and after that, when you come back to job, they don't do nothing. Because they know I'm fighting the right thing. I'm doing the right thing. There is nothing wrong. So that's part of the freedom of speech. That's part of the 10th, you know, amendment. That's the freedom of speech, freedom to gather, you know. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. Because I'm the only person. I speak out about that. So there's an article in The Guardian for me talking about what's going on in the Senate. Mm-hmm. That's catch up the senator's attention to find out what's going on. Mm-hmm. I was working in the Senate, and people are not respect. People are not treated with dignity. So all of this situation wake up my mind, and then I have to say something and then go on a strike. So today, I see a big change.
Now,
not for me. I want that change to be nationwide. That's why my fight is not about the people working in D.C. It's about the nationwide. All American workers deserve $15 as a minimum wage just to start. And the union, the freedom.
Amen. And when you were there, were there other workers that were with you that were participating in this? Was everyone involved? Was it just a few people or what?
No, everybody was involved.
Everybody. Okay.
Like today, yeah, everybody for different contractors. We have people from the zoo, from the Supreme Court, and for different government sites.
Mm-hmm. And so there was no bean soup for the senators today, is that right?
No, yeah, there was all workers across the city, not only from the Senate. Because we start, but we always have people to fight, because it's Good Job Nation now not working only with the Senate. They're working with a different contract worker.
Okay, I see. And so it was in the Senate, and then what were some of the other sites that were involved today?
That's the museum, the Supreme Court, and the zoo, and the Pentagon. Yeah, Pentagon, and so forth, different group.
And so were you guys able to actually meet with your employer today, or were you able to talk to any senators, and what were their reactions? How did they respond?
They respond, they're used to that, because they know any time I want to strike, if I don't come to work, they know I'm telling the truth. But any senator, no. The senator speak out. We have all the Democrat senators in the Congress support our action, our fight, support it.
Okay.
All Democrat senators in the Congress, the Senate, they support our fight. And I have, Warren, Senator Warren. He always support us. And I didn't know if he's going to run for president. Back then, Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, come on a strike with us. He came to strike with us because we didn't know he's going to run for president. Because all the Democrats, the Democrats support our action, our fight. They're pushing the president to sign $15 and the union.
So would you say that Senator Warren and Senator Sanders were more vocal, or were there other senators who were just as vocal as those two, or what?
I mean, all the Democrat senators, they signed a letter, mm-hmm. what I think 51 or 50, they signed a letter to push President Obama to sign an executive order for $15 in the union.
Ah, okay.
And in the meantime, I was saying, when you want to strike, Senator Bernie Sanders, I think he came twice. We were on the strike, he came twice. Mm. But we didn't know he will run for president. That's something we didn't know. Because all of a sudden, we see he's running. And then, you know, all the Democrats support our fight.
Sure.
But I think in this president, something, we have to do something for $15 and the union. Because I can't believe, like America, one of the powerful countries in the world, a blessing country, people cannot live in poverty. Poverty cannot be in America, the richest country, a powerful country, a blessed country. That's something I don't understand. I don't get it. That's why I make a commitment. I will fight for poverty. That's my commitment. Nationwide, it doesn't have to be in Washington, D.C. It should be across the country. People have to make a living wage. Just to start by $15 instead of people getting $7, $25. It doesn't solve the problem, the $7, $25. But $15, that's a first start. That's a start. The first step, I mean.
Sure. And $15 an hour, how is that pretty good for a standard of living in Washington, D.C.? I'm curious.
Yeah, that's, for a start, yeah, that's to pay bills.
Okay.
Just to pay bills. Just to pay bills, that's okay. That's why I say this is the first step, because we have to figure out how much people can make mm-hmm. in order to have a decent life, to pay school tuition. There's a lot of things. $15 cannot solve, but it's a first step. And we got to figure out what to do about, like, education, all is coming together.
And so what do you think that the next step is for Good Jobs Nation, for Senate cafeteria workers and low-wage workers across the United States? What is the next step?
The next step, we should need a voice. Because, for example, at my workplace, we don't have a union. So we don't have to go on a strike anytime. That's why we need a vocal. We need a union. A union at any American workplace should have a union. So workers cannot go on a strike. So the union will be able to deal, to talk with the employer, the employer.
Uh-huh, the umpire.
That's
sure,
the only
sure.
way to stop people going on strike. We're going on strike because we don't have nobody to speak on our behalf. Because if we have a union, we don't have to go. So union will be there to make sure, like, we are treated with justice and integrity. That's the reason we need a union. That's the first we need a union. And then from union, we'll move to different stuff.
Sure. And do you think that this is something that's going to happen within, say, the next year, the next 2 years, the next 5 years? What do you think? What is your sense?
No, I think it will happen this year.
This year?
This year it will happen, because that's why I was telling from start that Wolf is running for the president. We have to make a pledge to talk to American people. Mm-hmm. When I get elected, this is the first thing I have to do.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter. Ted Cruz, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But as far as I know, Senator Bernie Sanders already said that he's for $15 and the union. He already make a commitment.
Okay.
But the other three, I think they can do the same. They have to let to American people.
And I'm sure it's just a matter of time before Donald Trump signs on to $15 and the union, don't you think?
I mean, there is not too late, because if you want to run for the president, you got to take care of the people, the government for the people, by the people for the people. And I think we can do it. We have to do it. We have to do it. We have to speak to the people. If I was elected, this is what I'm going to do. I mean, it's like a pledge. If we make that pledge, and they will know exactly whoever is going to be the next president, won't be for the billionaire, for the rich people, but for the people. The people who are starving, the people who are living in poverty. That's something unacceptable in a richest country like America. It's unacceptable. We have people making $7.25 and rely on food stamp. That's something is unacceptable. We can stop it. We can stop it. Because we have all resources to stop it. Just creating jobs. Because the facts people making, if people start making $15, it's a count on the business. People will buy food. This is a boost for economy.
Sure.
The more people spend money, the more the economy will grow. Because if people don't have no job making $7, what they have to do? There's nothing. That's why we have all those kind of like social issues in America. All kind of social issues in America. And I can say, for example, if someone go to jail, he can't find a job. He got a record. Mm-hmm. When he come out from the jail, he cannot find a job. What this person have to do? The person already pay his time being on jail. But when he get out from the jail, he cannot find a job. We have so many issues. That's what I'm saying. Like, we got to make sure everything is right. So people will be happy. People are willing to work. But sometimes they cannot find a job because of you got a criminal record. So all the stuff make people not going to work. And then what happened? That's become like the burden of our federal government through government subsidy, through food stamp, to Section 8.
Sure. And I think that there, you know, these businesses have enough money. For example, the company that you work for, what is the name of the company?
I work for Restaurant Associate Campus Group.
Okay.
Restaurant Associate.
Now,
this is a British company.
It's a British company. And that's what I was going to ask you. Are they claiming that they don't have enough money to pay the $15 an hour? What is their argument against your demands?
No, I think we have enough money because we made like $4 billion as a profit during 2015. The previous year we make $4 billion as a benefit. When we went on strike, we try to adjust it, the pay for the people. Because I think right now, the lowest paid for people working in the Senate, mm-hmm. I'm talking in the Senate, is $13.82. Before, it used to be $10. And I myself, I used to make $12.30 mm-hmm. when we went on strike. And now, there's a big change. I'm making now $17.97 an hour, which is good, but not for me. It doesn't mean I'm making $17 as a cook. I will be silenced. No, I won't be silenced because I'm not happy. I will be happy if all American workers start making $15 as a minimum wage. That's right. Why I will go on strike. I will keep going on strike till people can start getting $15 and the union.
And what is the lowest wage again in the Senate cafeteria? And how many people actually work in the Senate cafeteria, all included?
We do have 83 or to call you have 83 people or 53 because we have the people who used to work for the government before because when the government privatized. Mm-hmm. The cafe, and they give a contract to Restaurant Associate.
I see.
So pretty much like 50, 60 people. And Compass, the company I do work, they already start doing something. What about all the company, for government site in Kansas City, Missouri? How those workers are making? It doesn't have to be in the D.C. It should be like all contract workers, and all workers in Castle America deserve $15. $15 for all workers across America. It is $15. And I will fight for that.
And so,
that's
Mr.
Olatel, become a fight.
What would you say to some people? Because I've heard the argument that, you know, you don't need to make $15 an hour. All you do is flip burgers for a living. All you do is do fries. All you do is pour Coca-Cola. So why do you need to make $15 an hour? Have you heard that argument? And what do you say?
I mean, if I hear those argument, maybe those people doesn't know. Maybe those people never live in poverty, but they don't know what it means making less money. And I think if you are in a situation, you will see things different. Because when you live in a palace, you don't know what's going on for someone living in a ghetto. Because someone living in a ghetto doesn't fit the same way for someone who lives in a big city, I mean, in the suburb. That's between like a middle class. We have a middle class, we are upper classes. If you're in the middle class, you know exactly what's going on. Because the cost of life is not like $10, $7. What are you going to do with $7?
Right.
You got to pay transportation. So 15 is a star. Because it depends on several states. Because the president can make it happen. Because if he signs an executive order, I don't see. If you don't want to do the business, why you want to treat people like a slave? People deserve 50. I mean, you say fry the burger. What I mean? Because you guys go to buy the burger because someone have to do this job.
Right.
You flip the burger or dip the fry in a fryer. That's fine. But how are you going to pay your bills? With $10? Plus taxes, you pay taxes. We take federal taxes. We take state taxes. And you work like your gross income, for example, a week is $400. But what do you have by the end of the week? Nothing. Back in 99, when I used to work at the Cook, at the Harris Casino, I used to make $8, I think 15 cents. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks, I have like 350, something like that. What do you have to do about it? When you have a family, are we going to send your kid to school? Because if we don't make anything, the government, our government will be, I mean, our government will always spend money. We
right.
have to create a job, $15, and people will go to work. That's a good thing.
Bertrand, I'm going to have to cut you off right there, and I wish you all the best of luck with everything that you're doing and your continued fight. And we hope that the presidential candidates that you have spoken with or have sent letters to respond by pledging their support for $15 and a union for all contract workers. And again, best of luck, and thank you so much again for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Molly Madden, and tonight we have a speech by the co-founder of ROC United, Restaurant Opportunity Center United, which started after the 9/11 tragedy. The speaker tonight, Saru Jayaraman, is speaking at a Jobs with Justice conference earlier this year.
We are an organization, a national organization of restaurant workers, employers, and consumers. We're about 18,000 workers, 175 owners, and several thousand consumer members in the restaurant industry in 15 states across the country fighting for better wages and working conditions. We founded the organization just after 9/11 as a relief center for workers who lost their jobs at Windows on the World, which was the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center, and we've grown dramatically over the last 15 years. And the reason we've grown so fast is the explosion in this industry. The restaurant industry is right now the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of our economy. It is over 11 million workers. One in 12 Americans works in the industry, and one in two of us, as you just saw, has worked in the industry at some point in our lifetime. And yet it happens to be the absolute lowest paying employer in the United States. So every year the U.S. Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs in America, and every year we win the award. 7 of the 10 lowest paying jobs every year in America are restaurant jobs, and actually only 1 of the 7 lowest paying jobs that's a restaurant job is a fast food occupation. So 6 of the 7 lowest paying jobs in America are full service restaurant occupations, and 4 of the lowest jobs, the lowest paid jobs in America are actually tipped workers, workers who earn tips. And how is it that you've got one of the largest and fastest growing sectors of our economy proliferating the absolute lowest paying jobs? Well, all of our research points to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association. We call it the other NRA. They are the 10 most powerful lobbying group in Congress and the most powerful lobbying group in most state legislatures around the country, fighting to stop minimum wage from going up, fighting against EFCA, fighting against healthcare reform, fighting against everything we care about. And until this past year, I'd always gone around the country talking about if their power dated back 20 or 30 years to the moment when Herman Cain, remember Herman Cain, was their leader. Well, in doing research for my new book, which is called Forked, and that's because we are forked as an industry, and as an economy, in doing research for that book, come to find that the power of the other NRA doesn't date back 20 or 30 years, it dates back 150 years to the emancipation of the slaves and their origins of tipping in this country. So tipping actually didn't originate in the United States, it originated in Europe. So if any of you have seen Downton Abbey, think about Downton Abbey, right? It originated in the aristocratic homes of feudal Europe. Aristocrats would tip servants on top of a wage that they received. And rich Americans in the 1850s and 1860s would travel to Europe and come back and try to show off that they knew the rules of Europe. Well, there was a massive anti-tipping movement that rose up in the late 1800s, early 1900s, so powerful, so successful, that six states actually passed complete bans on tipping. It was not popular. It was declared undemocratic and un-American. It was seen that employers should pay their workers, not customers. But two industries, actually squashed that movement, which, by the way, spread to Europe and succeeded in Europe because the labor movement picked it up in Europe and said these workers are professionals, which is why we see very little tipping in Europe. But here in the States, two industries squashed that movement. One was the Pullman Train Company, and the other was the restaurant industry, both of which demanded the right to hire newly freed slaves and not pay them anything and let them live on customer tips. The first tipped workers in our country were largely black, former slaves. Well, the Pullman car porters, I'm sure you all know this history as labor movement leaders, formed the first black union in this country and won the right to an actual wage rather than relying on customer tips. But the restaurant workers were not so lucky. The labor movement did not stand for them. And in 1938, after the restaurant industry successfully argued for many decades that they shouldn't have to pay these former slaves anything at all, they should live on customer tips because they were valueless. That idea was codified into the very first minimum wage law that passed in 1938 as part of the New Deal under FDR, with full assent from the labor movement. And that law said you have the right to the minimum wage either through wages or through tips, which gave tipped workers the right to the first minimum wage of $0 an hour. And we went from $0 an hour in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, which is the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers in these United States in 2016. And $2.77 here in Washington, D.C. A $2.77 increase over almost a century. And over that century, the restaurant industry has essentially made the same argument over and over and over again. They said, it's okay, we don't have to pay these workers. They make tons of money in tips. And they paint the picture of a white guy working at a fancy restaurant or a fancy hotel like this, making a ton of money in tips. They'd love to use the number 100,000. He's making $100,000 a year in tips. When in fact, 70% of tipped workers in America are women. Largely women of color, women working at IHOP and Applebee's and Olive Garden and Red Lobster, women earning a median wage of $9 an hour, including tips, suffering from three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce, using food stamps at double the rate, and suffering from the absolute worst sexual harassment of any industry in the United States, literally, because when you're a woman living off tips, you have to tolerate whatever a customer might do to you, and you're encouraged by management to objectify yourself to make more money in tips. But here's the saddest part to me, standing with you, brothers and sisters in the labor movement. It's that that's because of us. It's not because of the right. It's not because of the NRA. We did this. We did this because over the last 100 years, in 43 states in this country, over and over and over again, we have struck the same compromise. It's happening today. We've struck the same compromise. The compromise is every time the minimum wage goes up, we as minimum wage advocates and labor advocates, we agree. We say, yes, it's okay. We'll let the minimum wage go up for everybody else, and the NRA will let us as long as the tipped workers are left out. As long as the tipped workers are left out. And that compromise has been made over and over and over again for 100 years in 43 states and in Congress. Now, seven states have said no to this, including California, which has had the same wage for tipped and non-tipped workers for decades. But 43 states, which actually have lower restaurant sales per capita, lower rates of tipping, these seven states are faring better on every measure than the 43 states, I see you, with lower wages for tipped workers. I was told I'd get a couple more minutes. Labor leaders and the head of the assembly in New York State said to us, well, how about if we all reached a deal and it was fine for all of you, but we just left out the tipped workers? And the labor leaders didn't say anything. We keep doing it over and over and over again. Well, thank God. You know, we started a campaign a couple of years ago called One Fair Wage, demanding the full elimination of the lower wage for tipped workers. The AFL-CIO actually passed the first resolution in its history in 2014, abolishing, saying we support abolishing the lower wage for tipped workers, which was great. Seven states followed by introducing legislation, and Congress followed by introducing legislation proposing the full elimination of the lower wage for tipped workers, but it still hasn't happened, even in one state. You're telling me to slow down, and you're telling me to stop, so I'm going to do my best. We have it moving. You know, states are moving. Even the industry is moving. Last year, we got industry legends Danny Meyer and Tom Colicchio to actually move their own restaurants away from this system and towards eliminating tipping altogether in their restaurants, eliminating the lower wage for tipped workers. And that followed by New York Times editorial board coming out in support of our campaign, One Fair Wage. And then USA Today's editorial board came out in support of One Fair Wage. And so we've got a lot of people with us, industry leaders, newspapers, and we can't get our own allies to stand with us and say no more compromise. We're not going to repeat this legacy of slavery over and over and over again. So somehow we need to figure out how to stand together. I was asked to come here and talk to you about how we frame our work as a racial and gender justice issue. I think you've heard me kind of say that the whole time, but for us, racial and gender justice in our organization is not just talking about how this disproportionately affects women of color or how this is a legacy of slavery. It's actually having an organization that is run and led by women of color, people of color, where it's not just the women of color in the streets, it's not just the women of color in the Facebook organization, it's women of color who create the strategy and make the decisions and run the organization and who are on the board of directors. We met Jessica yesterday, who is on the board of directors. And that's important to us, but it doesn't come without a cost. And it's very personal. That's 30 seconds more, I promise. It's very personal, because I can't tell you the number of times I've been called the word difficult. In fact, Saru being difficult was reasoning for why one locality, an economic justice organization, said we shouldn't actually fight for the full elimination of lower wage for tipped workers. They said, why? They said, because Saru is difficult. So I come to understand that difficult is a code word for a strong woman of color who won't let you come. Slavery. Who will decide whether we as a movement examine our own racial and gender justice issues? Who will decide ultimately who runs this country? Is it a trade lobby like the NRA, or is it we, the people?
We have Teo Reyes, an organizer for Rock United, on the line. Welcome, Teo. Uh-huh. Could you give us a brief history? How did 9/11 push these low-wage workers to finally get organized?
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me. The Restaurant Opportunity Centers United was founded by the survivors of Windows on the World, which was the restaurant at the top of the World Trade Center. And after the terrorist attack that brought down the Twin Towers, there were about 60 workers who were able to come together with Kathmandu and Sarajayaram and to found Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, a worker center for restaurant workers that was to improve wages and working conditions. And even though the first goal they had was to provide support for the survivors of Windows on the World, quickly, you know, they're organizing to ensure their struggle for good jobs got the attention of other restaurant workers in New York City, and it quickly blossomed into a citywide and eventually national organization.
And it said on your website that you did research into 15 different cities, and you had a section called Ending Jim Crow in the American Restaurants. Were some sections of the country worse than others?
Yes. There's definitely variation in treatment of workers, and some of it is, as you can expect, the federal subminimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 an hour, but states can raise that minimum wage of their own on their own, and there are seven states that have completely eliminated the subminimum wage, so that there's no differential, there's no subminimum wage for workers who depend on tips. Mm-hmm. And those seven states are California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Alaska, Montana, and Minnesota. And in those states, we see that there's much lower poverty rates, there are higher wages, and better outcomes generally for restaurant workers.
Yeah, on your website, you said L.A. is the largest restaurant industry and that they were the leading state to do away with tips. I would imagine the customers are pretty happy.
I think, yes. You know, California certainly has a vibrant restaurant industry. It's the largest in the country. And workers even, you know, earn a base wage that guarantees them a minimum income, and then they're also able to obtain tips. And in certain cases, allows them to obtain livable wage jobs, although, you know, there's still to grow there. And that's actually, you know, you mentioned our report on Ending Jim Crow. Part of what we're working for is to create career paths for workers if they start with entry-level jobs, they're able to work into livable wage jobs in fine dining. And those jobs are highly segregated. It's overwhelmingly white men that are able to get those high-paying positions in fine dining. And one of our primary goals in California and across the nation, but also California, since California's made such progress on wages, is to really see greater opportunities for all workers.
I was wondering if we could talk about the public cost of low wages, you know, like food stamps and all the things that people weren't earning half the wage have to live on. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, it's a public cost to the taxpayers that could be going to schools and things like that.
Restaurant workers, again, there's regional variation, but across the country, they depend on food stamps at twice the rate of the rest of the workforce. They're twice as likely to live in poverty. And so, you know, this essentially means that these low wages that the restaurant industry is able to pay are being subsidized by the rest of us. You know, essentially, you know, we're subsidizing. In general, what you'll find is that, and outside of casinos, if you're looking in particular at family-style restaurants such as IHOP or Applebee's or Olive Garden, workers aren't insured a steady stream of tips.
Right.
You know, shifts change. Mm-hmm. There's different lunch shifts are going to be much slower than dinner shifts. On certain days of the week, it's going to be much lower. And so if you don't have a steady source of income and you're depending on the customer for tips, you'll find certain days you walk out with $20, other days you might walk out with $200, and it's impossible to really plan your finances that way. One of the things we've also found is that because of this dependence on the customer to pay for tips, we found that restaurant workers are particularly susceptible to sexual harassment in the states that have the much lower subminimum wages, because especially if you're in a state where the subminimum wage is $2.13 an hour, you mm-hmm. don't get a check. You get a check that says $0. This is not a check. And so everything, your entire income, comes from the customer, from the tips that you left.
And I don't think our audience knows that the Darden restaurants that pay so low. I mean, they wouldn't believe that Red Lobster would pay that low.
Olive Garden, Longhorn Steakhouse, Bahama Breeze, there's several, Darden chains. Darden is the largest full-service restaurant chain in the country, a couple hundred thousand workers that they employ, and 20% of their workforce earns $2.13 an hour. They've stated that publicly.
Yeah. And they also talked in your website about the National Restaurant Agenda. I don't believe people mm-hmm. know how powerful they are. Would you say a few words?
Yeah, the National Restaurant Association is one of the most powerful trade lobbies in the U.S. It is largely unknown. We call it the other NRA. But they wield tremendous influence. The last time the subminimum wage was raised was in 1991. That's when it went up to $2.13 an hour. And after that, the Restaurant Association negotiated with Congress. It was actually Herman Cain was the head of the Restaurant Association at that time. Negotiated with Congress not to try to block any further increases to the minimum wage as long as they froze the subminimum wage. And so that's why since when the wage did finally go up in 1996, it did not go up for workers. But that trade lobby, spent together with some of its biggest members, it spent over $300 million ensuring mm-hmm. its influence in Congress.
Right. Did you have any pushback from the high-end waiters who didn't want to give up the tips?
We have conversations with waiters because there's a lot of misinformation. When you look at the states that have this one minimum wage for all workers, those states also tend to have higher rates of tipping. Alaska, which is one of those one wage states, they have the highest rate of tipping in the country. Actually, there is no. Raising that subminimum wage for tipped workers does not impact workers in fine dining, but there is that misconception that employers really try to use to try to build opposition to any increase in minimum wage among workers themselves. But it's a small majority of workers and the vast majority that work in more casual full service chains. Stand to benefit immensely from the minimum wage increase.
Thank you so much, Teo, for
thank you.
Your contribution.
That's been lovely.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel, an apprentice wireman with IBEW Local 124. The Agricultural Workers Organization, AWO, an organization of farm workers throughout the United States and Canada, was formed on April 15, 1915, here in Kansas City. In 5 years, membership had grown to over 25,000 farm workers. Unlike many unions of the time, the AWO stressed solidarity and organizing across racial lines. This is a passage from an article in the International Socialist Review, written in 1915, that gives an idea of what these workers were up against. Among the Harvesters by Niels H. Hansen, Part 3. War wages during war prices. Strenuous efforts are being made to prevent the migratory workers from organizing this summer. The farmers would rather see them living on handouts in Chicago, New York, or Kansas City than pay them living wages. But the workers are saying to the farmers, "You are expecting war prices for your wheat, and you will have to pay us war wages, too, or do the work yourself. $3 for a 10-hour day is the lowest wage we are going to accept this year, with 50 cents extra for every hour overtime. We have not only the slugging, holdups, and possible jail sentences to contend with while we ride the rod for thousands of miles in order to gain a stake for the winter. Some of us go up against the employment sharks. You have probably heard of the type of buzzard that will send working men off for several hundreds of miles, where some accomplice will employ them for a day or two and then discharge them. This enables the employment shark to bleed every applicant with a few dollars in his pocket of several dollars apiece. Solidarity of labor. But it is not only the employer and his servants, the public authorities, with whom we have to contend. The workers themselves are their own greatest enemy. It is the lack of solidarity, the lack of sticking together that causes all our unemployment and our wretchedness. Most of the organized railroad men are ready to obey the rules of their masters and pitch in to us in order to hold their jobs. They stick to the boss instead of sticking to the workers of their own class. And next month, when this same railroad man is in the fix that we're in today, he will find other organized working men who will throw him off a train or scab on him or spy on him at the commands of the boss. But as the migratory workers learn to unite, to stick together, they will be able to ride and to eat and to get more of the value of the crops that they harvest. What the workers need is class solidarity, one big union of all the workers. When they learn that by uniting together and sticking up for, instead of fighting, each other, they can win anything, can even abolish the present system wherein they are robbed of nearly all they produce, the workers will be the real masters of the bread. Railroad men will learn that the man who rides the freight is a working man, a comrade in the struggle, and will lend him a hand. The mechanic will learn that the unskilled worker is as important as the skilled laborer, and that the skilled laborer must cooperate with him in a common struggle against the exploiting bosses. The driver of the engine who hauls the grain from the fields will learn that he would have no job if there were no low-down bums to reap and thresh the grain, and he will unite with the dollar and a half a day man against the master class. Organize with your comrades, you harvest workers, you railroad men, you mill and factory and mine workers. Organize to take control of the plants, the lands, and the roads, and the mines that you operate. Organize to make this the world of the workers. The advent of farm machinery crippled the union, and the last national convention was held in Seattle in 1929. This has been Remember Our Struggle. Have a great evening, fellow workers.
And now for the Heartland Labor Forum calendar. Taxes, what are they good for? Well, the American Friends Service Committee wants to know. You can post what you think online before April 15th, so do it quick. Go to http://bit.ly, that's bit.ly/taxeswhat, and post what you think taxes are good for, like maybe roads. The second water collection for Flint, Michigan is going to take place Saturday, April 16th between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. at the Teamsters Local Union Hall at 4501 Cleaver Boulevard. Bring water and look for the Teamster trailer where you will load it up and they will haul it to Flint. Wyandotte County Democratic Breakfast, also Saturday, April 16th, 8:15 for breakfast, 9:15 for the talk, which is going to be by Senator Pat Petty and Abby Hodgson, who is Chief of Staff for the Kansas House of Representatives Democratic Caucus. That's at the Dot Spot Bar and Grill at 8123 Parallel Parkway in KCK. And if you want to eat, RSVP to scottmackey08@yahoo.com. Celebrate the birthday of A. Philip Randolph. That's also tomorrow, April 15th, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. at the Bruce Watkins Cultural Center. This is a fundraiser for the A. Philip Randolph Institute, a bridge between labor and the black community. Worker Justice Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, April 18th, 5 to 8 p.m. If you got ripped off by your employer, there's lawyers there who can help you. That's at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, Kansas City, Kansas. And the Cross Border Network will be having its May Day dinner Friday, April 29th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Visionary Impact Theater, 1017 North 6th Street in Kansas City, Kansas. There'll be Central American food, spoken word with Norma Cantu, and music by the Subtropicales. For tickets, go to crossbordernetwork.org. That's it for tonight's show. You can find our complete calendar and our archived shows as well as our upcoming schedule on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week. Our show is going to be about corporate raiders who crash the classroom. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Beth Pike. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is really going to be an unusual program with teen poets from Paseo High School.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.